dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man we have had the pleasure of working with for, well, decades now in various incarnations in freedom fighting on behalf of the free world is our friend and colleague, Dr. Harold Rode. He was a longtime duty expert for the Secretary of Defense under successive secretaries and successive administrations, for that matter, on matters involving the Middle East. He's deeply knowledgeable about Iran and about Turkey and about Israel and the region more generally, as well as being a utility infielder on the rest of the world, pretty much. Harold Rode is these days a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute and the author, among other things, of a Center for Security Policy Press publication entitled Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. Harold Rode, it's good to have you back, and thank you for giving us two segments of your time. We so appreciate your both expertise as well as your accommodating these requests for tapping it with some regularity for our audience. Glad to have you with us. Let me ask you about the speech that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, delivered from a city you know well, you live in sometimes in the year when the coronavirus is not keeping you home, Jerusalem, the holy city. It is a speech that I think has a number of different attributes to it. Let's start with the substantive content. What did you make of it and its importance, do you think?
First of all, it was a joy to hear Secretary of State Pompeo not only say what he said, but Jerusalem means so much to him. And the truth is, it means so much to so much of the American people. So to hear him from there was wonderful. And that's where he was when the convention was being held. So, of course, why shouldn't he speak? Now, what did he spoke about Trump's accomplishments. He's the first president to stand up to China, to call China for what it was and what it's doing and how it's trying to undermine the United States. And it's very polite. The ancient Chinese philosopher said anything you can do without using military force, it's preferable that way. And we always seem to only think in terms of peace or war. Well, the Chinese have their strategy is always to undermine from inside when they want something. And that's what they've done. And Secretary Pompeo understands this beautifully.
And has really been the architect of the strategy for opposing it, has he not?
Mm-hmm. To the best of my knowledge. I mean, I'm no longer in government, but that's what I understand.
Certainly from his public comments, as well as the influence that he's having on the thrust of American policy, I think there's no doubt about that. And he did, you know, briefly address it very pointedly. It was, even in a couple of minutes, orders of magnitude more than we heard out of the Democrats in the entire course of their program the last week.
Maybe I'm wrong, Frank, but I don't even, from what I remember, the Democrats didn't even mention China.
I think there was exactly one reference to it in at least the Biden speech. His acceptance speech had a passing mention of the fact that we need to have our own sources of medicines, not rely on China. But that was about it, Harold, which is just stunning because, as you know, as a serious national security practitioner of long standing, the next commander-in-chief, whoever that's going to be, is going to have this as job one. Whether it's for the national security reasons or whether it's for the economic reasons or whether it's the public health reasons. And to give it such short shrift to effectively prevent the American people from knowing what his position is on China is a real disservice, it seems to me.
Well, look at his own, Mr. Biden or Vice President Biden's relationship in the past with China. Basically, the Democrats have a history of giving in to evil forces in the world. And that's sad. Look, I'm a born Democrat. I was a Democrat growing up, a Scoop Jackson Democrat.
It's not that party anymore, though, that's for sure. I think our friend Scoop Jackson is rolling at a pretty high RPM in his grave as he looks at what's happening at the moment. Harold, of course, Secretary Pompeo touched upon a number of other subjects. He talked about, pushing back on the Russians and getting rid of a treaty that prevented us from properly defending Europe. He talked about not least the Middle East, and I want to come to that in just a moment. But before we do, I just wanted to ask you, you mentioned that the fact that he was making this speech from Jerusalem has caused some consternation in certain quarters. The Democrats have really gone after Mike Pompeo, claiming that he has violated the Hatch Act, a piece of legislation that says you can't, engage in political matters if you are a serving government official. What did you make of this line of attack? And is it any surprise that they're mounting it against a man who's so prominent and so effective in the president's cabinet at the moment?
Well, if you listen to what he said in Jerusalem from last night, all he did was describe the accomplishments of President Trump from President Trump's presidency, and that was simply listing things. Does that say that it's a violation of laws? Come on, Frank. You and I know from all the years we worked in government that whenever someone opposed you and they didn't have the intellectual arguments to defeat you, they always came up with, you violated this, you violated that. And if you just push a little, you realize that it was all politics. We're not talking truth here. All Secretary Pompeo did last night was list truth. He didn't. This wasn't a political speech. But, you and I know that from our own experience, sad experience, that's how they work. When they can't get you on your arguments, they try to do personal attacks. And they'll get you any way they can.
The ad hominem attacks are one thing. It's the accusation that somehow he's violated the law. I think you could probably point to 40 different speeches that Mike Pompeo has given during the time he's been in this particular job, before that, obviously, the Central Intelligence Agency, but in which he simply did a similar kind of laundry list of accomplishments. Of course, he was making it as a presentation to this convention, but I think that's not something that is untoward, personally. And when I look at the history of political machinations of past secretaries of state, notably Obama's, Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, I think this pales by comparison, don't you? Harold, we're going to have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want to, as I said, visit with you at some length about several of the flashpoints that you cover so well at the Gatestone Institute in the Middle East. And we'll do that and more with Dr. Harold Rode straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting for this segment, as with the last, our friend Dr. Harold Rode. We're very pleased to have him. And Harold, I promised that we would talk a little bit about a number of the hotspots in your portfolio of the Middle East. Let's start with a spot that may be cooling, according to some. There has been a bit of a rapprochement announced between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. What did you make of the announcement, and what do you think it's likely to produce?
I think the Emirates, the UAE, are sick and tired of the Palestinian issue. They believe that it's nothing more than they're all made to try to feel guilty if they don't support them. And the fact is that the UAE and Israel have the same agenda. They are worried about Islamic terrorism all over, and they are concerned that a lot of the Palestinians in the Gulf and in other places are being supported by various organizations which want to destroy the governments of the Persian Gulf. It's not just the UAE. It's Bahrain. It's the Saudis. Any type of aid that these people in the Gulf have been giving to the Palestinians over the year is basically bribe money. If you won't do anything to us, we will leave you alone.
So, Harold, does this mean that because Israel and the UAE have similar interests, particularly vis-a-vis, well, Palestinian and other Islamic terrorism, but also vis-a-vis Iran, that there will be full normalization of relations? And does the price that was paid for this, apparently by Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, in terms of, well, as he puts it, suspending, I think, or deferring extension of sovereignty by Israel over parts of the West Bank, also known as Judea and Samaria, is that all coming together as you see it, and was that a good deal?
Look, Judea and Samaria is the ancient Jewish homeland. What Netanyahu said, and I think he very, very clearly, this is suspension. The extension of sovereignty can take place anyway. The truth is that if you go around there to the Jewish towns and villages in Judea and Samaria, if they have sovereignty over this, or this area, that is, if the Israelis do, it won't change one thing on the ground. And so people understand it's the ancient Jewish homeland. And in an odd way, and I know this may sound like reverse logic, that the fact that a lot of the people living in these towns and villages are so upset actually helps the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan and others saying, see, they got the Jews there got all upset and we pushed it off, and that will help them make, shall we say, the initial jump to full diplomatic relations with Israel. And nothing will change on the ground there. And I have no doubt in my mind that the Israelis will eventually extend sovereignty to this area, which from a legal point of view, we always talk about international law and legal thing, but from a legal point of view, there's only one treaty, one document, which really talks about who owns this land, and that's the Treaty of San Remo in 1920, which makes it very clear that this land is to be the land, the homeland of the Jewish people.
And when you say this land, you're talking about Judea and Samaria in its entirety, not just certain parts of it. But Harold, let me just ask you, there is some talk out of MBZ, as he's known, the mayor of the UAE, that the normalization process is a roadmap rather than something that is now, you know, going to happen for sure. Do you find that to be troubling, or is that not to be worried about?
Well, this is the Middle East, and remember, these people have been around for a long, long time. If things take a little longer, so be it. But the fact of the matter is, that's the way they're going. The fact that they even announced publicly in the UAE that they want full diplomatic relations with Israel, and there's a plane that went from Israel to UAE with all sorts of people talking about technicalities. We're flying right over Saudi Arabia. That's Saudi sovereignty. That's tacit Saudi agreements of the whole thing. The direction we're moving in is a wonderful direction. And let's things, you know, Americans, it's like little kids. They jump up and down. I want my candy now, right away. I want to know, what are you doing? What are you doing? Does this little kid deserve the candy? And what we're seeing is the direction is clear, and that's all that matters.
Let me ask you about Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the dictator for life, apparently now, of Turkey. He entertained Hamas in his country recently. Tell us a little bit about what that suggests, or further confirms, perhaps more accurately, about where Erdogan stands. One of the members of this delegation that he entertained is a man, I understand from Breitbart, who has a $5 million bounty on his head in connection with his involvement in terrorism from the United States government. I'm interested in, you know, where that leaves us vis-a-vis the Turks, and not least what the Turks are up to with respect to the Muslim Brotherhood here in our own country as well.
Well, the shall we say the titular head of the Muslim Brotherhood in the world is Erdogan. I mean, he does. It's not a formal title. There isn't such a thing. And the Muslim Brotherhood is out basically all throughout the Gulf, all throughout the Muslim world. Its complaint is that the leaders there are working with the non-Muslims, obviously the head being the United States. And for that reason, all these leaders should be killed. Now, Hamas is part, basically, of the Muslim Brotherhood. Its constitution says so. They're very clear. They hate America. Now, what has been a little hard for me to understand from time to time is that the administration has seemed, at times, very soft on Erdogan. I have no idea why, but the fact that publicly the State Department is now condemning Erdogan for meeting with Hamas senior terrorist leaders, as you mentioned, the one with $5 million bounty on its head. It's important. And the other thing is, it's more important that Erdogan is offering Turkish citizenship to all of the Hamas people, who, again, they stand only not to destroy Israel, but they want to destroy the United States of America. Now, in this country, we live in the Beltway. The Turks, excuse me, let's say Erdogan. I want to make a distinction between Turkey, which is Atatürk's principles, the founder of the republic. We support that very much, but they're not in power. They have no power to speak of in Turkey right now. But Erdogan and company, they have a huge mosque complex right off the Beltway here in Washington, D.C. And they are, if you look at a lot of what they're doing in mosques in the United States, it is viciously anti-American. Now, why do we allow this?
I don't know, Harold, and it's very worrying because I think that's the visible part of what they're doing, and what's less visible is active collaboration with, underwriting of, and perhaps even directing the Muslim Brotherhood's, well, fifth column operations in our country as well. Harold, one other topic that I want to hit quickly with you is, in Mike Pompeo's speech, Iran featured prominently. He noted the important efforts the president has been making to counteract the mistakes of the past vis-a-vis specifically the Obama-Biden administration's efforts to prop up the mullahs, to enrich them, to empower them, to embolden them. Where do things stand at the moment, as you see it, with respect to Iran in the face of the end of the Iran deal, nuclear deal, that is, as well as, of course, the maximum pressure campaign? And speaking of China, what's going on between the Iranians and the Chinese at the moment that it seems very clearly intended to undo the effects of President Trump's policy course correction?
Oh, absolutely. But just first of all, in a general thing, we're now going to have snapback some sanctions. Now, what that means is that before the Obama-Iran agreement in 2015, if my memory serves me correctly, there were very serious sanctions on Iran because of its nuclear program, which were really, really hurting. And the Obama-Biden people did their best with Secretary Kerry, who, frankly, has been advising the Iranians. No, that, if anything, has to be a violation of all the acts that you and I were accused of violating over the years. you know, we're all, but remember when the Israelis captured the Iranian archive, the nuclear archive, it proved beyond a question of a doubt, they shared this with us here, the Israelis, that all along the Iranians continued their nuclear program. Now, on the business of the UN resolution, and just in the last week or so, and America can't invoke snapback sanctions. America can do anything it wants, and it is invoking them. And there is a whole bunch of new things that America could do. For example, there are 14 banks, Iranian banks, that are allowed to do business in the world, and we know that they have been financing at least part of the Iranian nuclear program, and we can put sanctions on Iran. We can do it.
Harold, thank you for your time. Thanks for the work you do at the Gatestone Institute. And of course, we greatly appreciate Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. You can get that free from the Center for Security Policy Press as a PDF at securefreedom.org. Harold, come back to us again soon, if you would. It's great to talk with you. Next up, we'll speak with former CIA operative Sam Faddis about revolution here and Beijing Biden right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're joined by one of my favorite people, a great guest, a tremendous public servant, now in the private sector doing the Lord's work, helping the rest of us understand what's afoot in terms of threats to our country from enemies foreign and domestic, people he promised in the course of several of his previous incarnations, through a formal oath he took to defend our Constitution against. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. Among other things, he was an Army officer and Judge Advocate General. He was a former undercover clandestine service Central Intelligence Agency operative. He was an assistant attorney general in Washington State. He has been a candidate for Congress. He's an author of fiction and nonfiction books in the latter category, an especially important one, Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Among other things, he's a busy guy. He manages a very, I think, impactful online resource, andmagazine.com. And it's always good to have a chance to visit with him, as we are privileged to do from time to time. Sam Faddis, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have you with us. Let me talk to you about Kenosha, if I can, Sam. You used to be in the business of trying to foment, well, uprisings, I guess, to advance freedom. There's a revolution, as best I can tell, underway in this country at the moment for the purposes of snuffing freedom. Is that what we're seeing in the little town of Kenosha, Wisconsin, at the moment, among other places?
Yeah, I think that there is no question that that is precisely what you are seeing. I mean, a large portion of the media still wants to use terms like peaceful protest and pretend like what we're seeing are spontaneous disturbances of some kind. That is not what is happening. I mean, there are specific incidents that are used as pretexts, but that's all they are. And there is an extremely high level of organization. The level of violence is ramping up, and this is not something that's going to die down. This is intended to be, this is an insurrection. Let's just use that word.
Well, that's the lesser category. The higher category might be actual the revolutionary overthrow of our country and government. But Sam, when you talk about that, who's responsible for this insurrection, if you will, or revolution in Kenosha and elsewhere? Is it the same people? Is it some larger national enterprise? Is it something that is benefiting from foreign intervention?
Well, I think you've hit on an extremely important question here, which is who exactly is directing this and funding this, and where is that coming from? I don't know that I have that answer right now. What I can tell you is, as you said, having been in this business, this is not just a bunch of disparate groups functioning independently who somehow magically coordinate all their efforts across the country. That's not the way this works. So there are, in fact, clearly people pulling strings and making plans, and somebody in the federal government, like starting with the FBI, ought to be running that down and establishing that, and that entire network that coordinates all this ought to be being pulled out by the roots right now.
Sam Faddis, you worked in senior positions in the United States government, so I'm sure you have some thoughts on this. Are you surprised that the FBI seems to be so flat-footed on this? I've been told that they have all of about five informants inside Antifa, and heavens only knows what inside the Black Lives Matter organization, if any. You know, you've had uprisings, in some cases very violent and destructive ones, in over 100 cities across this country. It does seem as though this has not been getting the kind of attention that it deserves to this point, and maybe even now.
Well, I am dismayed, but I can't say that I am actually surprised. And I don't think this is so much a reflection on the individual members of the Federal Bureau of Investigation as it is a reflection of the fact that politically we have steered away from collecting on this target for a very long time. You can't go penetrate leftist groups without getting yourself in political trouble. So, yeah, we have a revolution on our shores. We are seeing a revolution in the streets of our country, and our premier domestic intelligence collection apparatus is apparently largely blind on what's happening. That's exactly where we are. That's terrifying.
It is terrifying, and unfortunately it's true as well, I believe, of the Muslim Brotherhood and other Sharia supremacist operations that are also at work in this country, which I think in that case, as well as in this, there is evidence have foreign involvement. In the case of the Brotherhood, I think there's no question that Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Turkey is up to its eyeballs in what the Brotherhood is doing here. And it seems as though China has a hand in some of this revolutionary activity on the part of the radical left as well. And to not have our, you know, counterintelligence apparatus effectively engaged in it and seemingly chasing after mostly so-called white supremacist threats does seem to be a real fundamental breakdown in terms of critical national security capability.
Yeah, without question, what people really ought to keep in mind is this is bad now. This is going to get much worse. It's going to spread because it is a revolutionary movement, and the level of violence is going to increase. We are going to go from burning and looting and all of this to car bombs and shootings, and that's where this is headed. Without question, that's where this is headed.
Well, needless to say, I pray that's not the case, Sam Faddis, but I fear you're right, and it does urge and demand more effective action than we've seen to date to stop it. Let me turn to, I would argue, not unrelated subject, talking about the government getting things wrong. You have written about what you call Beijing Biden in one of your pieces recently at End Magazine. Sam, that's a pretty pejorative term. Tell us why it's nonetheless apt.
Well, my alternate term would be Trader Joe, but that's I mean, look, I find it laughable now that Mr. Biden runs around and attempts to convince us that if he's elected president, he's going to get tough on Beijing. I can't think of anything more ludicrous. I mean, this guy is one of the primary architects of everything we have done vis-a-vis the Chinese for decades now, gutting our industrial base, shipping our factories overseas, impoverishing our people, refusing to confront them in the South China Sea. We could go just down this list. Not to mention his son flew into Beijing and walked away with $1.5 billion in CCP blood money. I mean, this guy is bought and paid for by the Chinese. And by the way, the Chinese are making no secret of the fact, I'm obviously talking about the Chinese Communist Party, that they are cheering for him to be elected president. So that ought to tell you right there whose side he is on.
Well, they're cheering, but even more troubling, they are actively intervening in our election for the purpose, it seems, of securing his victory. It's no secret they don't like Donald Trump very much, and with good reason. He has taken them on, and there's no basis, I guess, for believing that Joe Biden would do so. And to the contrary, one might expect that he would continue the kinds of policies and practices that you've chronicled in your piece at AND. Speaking of AND, I did want to just say a word of thanks to you, Sam Faddis, for publishing one of my pieces there recently about a story we've been following a bit on the show, the possibility that there may actually be a cure for this CCP virus, as we think it's best described. Not you know, convalescent plasma, not remdesivir, not perhaps even hydroxychloroquine, but something called oleandrin. Any thoughts on that topic and why you thought it important to give it some press?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, if we are truly facing this pandemic, then we ought to be looking at every reasonable alternative, right? I mean, we're fast-tracking at to the tune of billions of dollars, multiple vaccines. You would think we would have time to explore something that is cheap and plentiful and just essentially has no adverse side effects. So I think we should be jumping all of this.
Yeah, and yet we're seeing the FDA do just about everything they can, it seems, to prevent it from being even tested, let alone brought to bear as a natural supplement without a prescription or you know, any fandango as a drug. Sam, we have to leave it at that. There's so much more that I would love to explore with you, and we'll do it on another occasion soon, I hope. In the meantime, thank you for your service to our country, which is not only quite exemplary in the past, but is continuing in a lot of different respects, including, of course, at andmagazine.com. Keep it up. Come back to us again soon, if you would, sir. Next up, we'll speak with Diana West about this moment we find ourselves in through the prism of the Republican National Convention and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for one of the highlights of our week, the visit we have just about every week with Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, a brilliant author of several really important books, including Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and not least, The Red Thread, The Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. You can find her work at dianawest.net, and of course, here with us each week. We're always delighted to visit with her. Diana, welcome back. Good to have you. Well, I wanted to get your take on the Republican National Convention that is taking place as we speak. It has been a virtual one mostly, but a lot of very impressive video, I think it's fair to say, and a lot of interesting individuals have been heard from so far, and a few more will be heard from in the course of today and tomorrow as well. So your takeaway?
Yes, well, you know, it's a virtual convention. There are very impressive speeches being made in this strange situation we're in which we don't have a real convention, we don't have a real campaign. So there is this oddity that as Kenosha, Wisconsin is being burned, we have the speeches at the Republican convention. Of course, there's no connection there, I'm trying to sound sarcastic. I mean, this is what is going on in our country. We are in a period of crisis. The message from the revolution, the message from the convention is very strong. I was very impressed with Nick Sandman's presentation, with Herschel Walker. The McCloskeys, I think, in some ways are speaking to this period of revolution in terms of the very basic desire to live and defend one's life and property, which, again, is playing out in these terrible riots and burning down of now this population 100,000 city in Kenosha. The message is great, but I mean, again, we're looking at a period of revolution, and in some ways, this virtual convention is you know, a marker we have to get through to get to the real battle, which is the election. So I have a mixed feeling about it all, just because it's playing out against this tremendous period of revolution, of crisis, and, you know, we have to get down to battle here.
It did seem to me, though, that a number of the speakers were pretty pointedly explaining what's going on here. I'm thinking of this Cuban-American, Maximo Alvarez, who was, you know, talking about his own personal life experience, coming to this country to get away from communism, the hardship that it inflicted upon his family, the opportunity that he had here, and most especially his very poignant statement that there's no place else to go. If we lose this country, that's it. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, Diana.
Right. Well, it's a very important message. And of course, it's again this notion of communism taking place, taking over, destroying other countries. And now we are confronted with it destroying this country. And what I would like to see discussed and described, whether it's in the convention setting, which is probably not going to happen, or in the coming days toward the months toward the election, is how it is that this period of rioting ostensibly over racial injustice is actually just another iteration of communist revolution using the most effective ideological weapon at hand, this ginned up racial guilt, this notion that systemic racism is our leading problem, which is an absolute big lie. There is no systemic racism in a country that elected a black president twice in all of our memories. I mean, this is ridiculous, and I could go down a long list of why there's no systemic racism, except perhaps we can talk about just in terms of systemic race-based policymaking. Of course, we've all lived for many decades under policies of affirmative action, which are supposed to remedy this kind of purported injustice and have created all other kinds of problems, which, you know, are things we can also discuss. But the only systemic racism is actually to advance non-whites into education positions, professional positions, and all the rest of it. So the idea that we are now in a crisis, it's not about race. It's about socialism. It's about revolution. It's about the seizure of power and the undermining of everything normal, including the election. So these are much bigger issues than these speeches, than this convention. And, you know, it's really almost it's a rallying of the troops, which conventions are, which is very important. I think the president, in this run-up to his actual acceptance of the nomination, has been tremendously strong and calm, and, you know, his discussions with the press and so on, and his appearances are tremendous given the pressures that he's continually under. So this is all very important, but we are ready. We are preparing for real battle going forward.
We better be, that's for sure. Diana, you tweeted out I thought, very powerful column at The Federalist by John Davidson, who professed to have changed his mind about something I think you intuited and spoke powerfully about 4 years ago, which is that Donald Trump has actually saved the Republican Party, not doomed it, which he initially had thought. Talk a little bit about how you see this party today as opposed to what it would have been had the establishment continued to be its dominant force.
Well, it's an interesting idea. What would have happened had Donald Trump never come around? The country would be in a very different place. I think that what Donald Trump restored to the Republican Party was its purpose in protecting and trying to put back together the nation itself. I mean, this is Donald Trump's signal achievement, whether he's successful ultimately or not. His achievement was to remind Americans and actually summon a mandate in 2016 to restore the nation. And this, yes, this should be the goal of the Republican Party. It's always struck me the Republican Party should have designed itself around being the Protect the Constitution Party, whereas the Democratic Party should have styled itself as the Socialist Party long ago, certainly since Franklin Delano Roosevelt's many terms.
So, Diana, I guess the point is that whether he has succeeded or not, whether, in fact, he's been vilified terribly by the Democrats, and notably in last week's convention they held, for dividing the country, that is, I think, unmistakably his purpose and certainly what the country needs at the moment. That's not something you're likely to read on social media. And I want to just to close with you. You sent me an interesting development. Robert Kennedy Jr., one of the heirs to the Kennedy brand, has sued Facebook and three of its so-called fact-checker entities over this issue of their censoring what is truthfully and necessarily to be known about the health crisis that we're facing from the CCP virus. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, and the stakes involved here.
Well, I think it's very significant that Robert Kennedy Jr., coming from the left, is joining in this effort to try to restore free speech to the public square as it is defined and dominated by big tech. And this is what we are all facing in terms of censorship of any thought, discussion, data, affidavits, experiences that do not comport with the party line as defined by the CDC, the World Health Organization. These are effectively, at this point, Chinese fronts. Certainly the World Health Organization, the CDC, and following it is following along in this same line of just punishing censorship, and the big tech is taking its cue from these supposed health organizations, which are political organizations. We have to start understanding them as having very little to do with health and much to do with political power. So Robert Kennedy Jr.'s and his children's health defense organization has joined a suit or actually initiated a suit against them on the same grounds that I would initiate such a suit against them, and in this very, very hot and important area of debate.
Convergence. Speaking of unity, this is an exciting moment. Diana, we'll talk more about this with you next week. We have to leave it at that for the moment, though. Thank you, as always, for your insights about what's going on in our country, in our culture, and in the trajectory for the future. There is much riding on decisions that the American people will be making shortly, and we appreciate so much your help in informing them. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.